Dave Dyer, this is a town obsessed with history. We're surrounded here in our studios by old buildings and the remnants of the Erie Canal. How is it that everybody around here seems to have forgotten Steeles?
That's a perfect question. You know, this guy, I think, invented the infomercial in 1922, and it was a silent film that he used to sell stock in his retail operation, and it was such a powerful tool that he sold stock to 60,000 people, three times more than Ponzi did in the prior year or two, and this was 1922. It was such a powerful, powerful film and so successful. And when they went out of business in 1923 and everybody lost their money, that was the end. And there is nothing else in writing about Steeles as the L.R. Steel Company was the official name. When I presented the book proposal to Syracuse University Press, the first thing they got back to me about was, we can't find anything else on this that's ever been published. Are you sure this is real? And so I had to send them some source documentation that I had found. And, you know, they said, wow, this is interesting.
Some of the buildings are still around. There's a building over here on Washington Street where I used to have lunch a lot to discover it was part of Steeles. Why did people forget it?
Yeah, that's a very hard question. But in 1923, when they went out of business, there were six indictments. And eventually those indictments were reversed by the government. So no, there was no show trial. The founder, Leonard Rambler Steele, this visionary entrepreneur who put the whole thing together, he had been forced out of the company just before the indictments came out. So there wasn't a figurehead right there. And then he was only 44 years old, and he was trying to buy the company back, and he was on a train in Toledo, Ohio, when he had a stroke and died suddenly. He was on his way to supposedly to meet with Henry Ford to ask for a $1 million loan so that he could buy his company back. So the founder was gone. The indictments went away. And it was 1923, and hey, you lost a little money, but the economy was great. Things were taken off, and there were other opportunities. So somehow it fell through the cracks until I was researching an ancestor who worked for the company. My ancestor was Clayton Pickard, and I found through a series of lucky events that he lived in Buffalo, which I didn't know, and changed his name to Clayton Pickard, presented himself as being French-Canadian, and lived under the radar until he died in 1962 at the ripe old age of 72. And in researching him, I found that he worked for this company, and I did a Google search on the L.R. Steel Company, and somehow, just by luck, about six pages or eight pages in, I found a large box of documents for sale on eBay that were listed as Americana, but it was all of the internal documentation from the L.R. Steel Company. So it was thousands of pages of meeting notes, of descriptions of people, events, parties, thousands of photos. And the entire scandal is viewed from the inside by the people who were participating in it at the time, who were enjoying the big parties, enjoying the big money, and it was just a fascinating tale. But the thing that put me over the top was the movie. When I read about the movie, it was a three-hour silent film produced in 1922, and he made 50 copies of it, and each copy had a different ending because he wanted it to end in the locality where it was shown. He had anticipated the value of localizing your advertising. And so he would show it. His stores, he had five and dime stores, cafeterias, things like that. The stores would be in a small town, Ottumwa, Iowa, Aurora, Illinois, Port Jervis, New York was one. I've got photos from Port Jervis. And he'd show it in a small town, and people would go crazy. They'd see their town with their store, and they'd line up the next morning to buy stock in the company.
It's interesting to me because this is 1921, 22, 23, and you're dealing with filmed infomercials. You're dealing with accounting that left something to be desired. You're dealing with a charismatic leader who has this great story and these great items to sell, and a whole bunch of people who want to put their, you know, 1922 equivalent of their 401ks into the stock for the LR Steel Company. And people keep doing it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They could see the stores. They could shop in the stores. In fact, Steele's idea was if people actually own the stores, they'd be more loyal to him. So he sold the stock in order to promote his business. And people bought into that. And it could have worked. His ideas were visionary in a lot of ways. I don't know if you saw the picture of his corporate headquarters, the Lincoln Building here on Washington Avenue, where he built out an entire floor with a bungalow inside the building, including a car sitting outside. And all of the items were laid out as they would be used in the home so that the customer could walk through the building, walk through the home, and see where these items would be used.
This is a time when Sears was selling houses that would arrive on Railway Express and you'd put the house together.
Yeah, but this was essentially what IKEA has ended up making a living at. So he had some great ideas. And what's interesting to me is that it could have worked. It didn't, obviously. It was a massive failure, and everybody lost their money. But with maybe just a little bit better accounting, a little bit better understanding of the fact that he wasn't just able to start a different company and sell stock in it, and then pay off that by starting another company and selling stock in it. If he'd had a little bit more control internally, or if the SEC was not available then to require registration of stock sales. So that would have helped a lot. But, yeah,
it's a pyramid sales scheme with real stuff.
Yeah, it was real. It was and he bought into it himself. All of his savings were in the company. So when he died, his wife and child were penniless. Even the federal government, which rarely happens, lost $60,000 in back taxes.
You know, it's a time of great enthusiasm, although a lot of people didn't realize how shaky the economy was down under the boom on Wall Street and so forth. But didn't anybody question all of this?
It actually fell apart when the state attorney general of Maryland questioned it. And he stopped the stock sales in Maryland. And then all of the other states said, whoa, what's going on here? And that caused it to stop. So when you pull out one peg, everything else fell.
Headquarters was here in Buffalo. And I guess there's still the one building that, or what's left of the building over here on Washington Street. And they used to hang out at the Lafayette Hotel a long time ago.
Sure.
Why here?
This was a boom town in the 1920s. Leonard Rambler Steele lived on Lafayette Boulevard, and he had a big house out near Gettysville. And he came here initially to work for another chain store company, Metropolitan Stores. And he was general manager of Metropolitan Stores, but he wanted his own business. So he left them and started his own business.
I would think people locally were willing to believe him because S.H. Knox was headquartered here.
Sure, yeah. And he knew those people. He was involved with them.
And this was obviously also a time where there were enormous changes in the retail business, you know, developing mammoth stores like A&P.
Well, what Steele caught was this boom after the war, after World War I. There was radio, there were electric lights, all of these fine new things that could be sold at a retail environment, in a chain store environment. And so not only did he have some great merchandising ideas, but there were new trends in merchandise for things that everybody wanted.
We had the Larkin stores here in the warehouse is a couple of blocks from here. It's now a bank headquarters.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, what you had were people who would move to Buffalo, severing their roots from wherever, and were willing to accept new ideas.
It was Silicon Valley. Exactly. It was new ideas, people getting rich, people driving nice cars. Steele's employees made an incredible amount of money. The salespeople who sold the stock would make as much as a family physician would make. And this was somebody with virtually no background in anything other than the ability to go out and be enthusiastic about selling the stock.
And your family member involved in all of this became engaged in the great American hobby of reinventing himself.
Yes, Clayton Pickard, my grandmother's only brother. She spent her whole life wondering, I wonder whatever happened to Clayton. I heard that so many times growing up. Grandma lived to be 93, and she never found him. She hadn't seen him since 1923, and it turned out he was involved in the company. He was an early employee. At one point, he was a vice president. He had various roles. He was never indicted, but when the company fell apart, his wife and family left him, moved back to Canada, and he apparently stayed here, changed his name, lived under the radar, never remarried, I was able to find his grandson living in Ottawa, and just by an incredible amount of luck, Clayton's son was still alive at 84, and I went up to Quebec to visit him, and he said, "Hey, I don't know what happened to my dad either." And then I found out.
When you look back at this period, you were in the business world.
Mm-hmm.
Could you still do this today? I mean, certainly you could have the great idea, but would the government let you get away with the stock sales and the accounting mysteries and all of that?
Well, certainly not in the same way, but, look what Bernie Madoff did. Bernie Madoff really got away with it. In fact, with all of the regulation that was going on, Bernie Madoff was not even making the trades that he was showing on the statements that he was sending to customers. So the regulation certainly helps, but I don't think Steele could. If Steele had been around today, I think he probably would have been successful because his business would have been forced by some regulation to be more successful. One of the problems they have with the SEC is that most of the people that work there are junior people who really want to get into the investment industry, and they're afraid to make anybody mad, and they really don't have, in a lot of cases, the technical background to understand what's going on. Although, like with Bernie Madoff, all they had to do was check and see if the trades had been made. They could have made 5 phone calls and killed that whole thing off, and nobody did it. So it might, regulation would have helped, but it's not 100%.
In Madoff's case, people knew. They just liked the income. The thing that killed Steele's was the stores really didn't make any money.
Exactly. They were popular. There were crowds. At store openings, he'd have a brass band. The big store in Denver, which was 3-4 stories of stuff, they had the police out for opening day because the crowds were so large and they couldn't let everybody in, and it was almost a riot. They locked the doors to keep people from pushing in, and then the police made them unlock the doors because it was a fire hazard to have the doors locked. The stores were popular, and he used the same idea that really has been popularized by Sam Walton, which is large stores in small towns selling 75% of what most people wanted. And that's a great concept.
Except it didn't work.
Yeah, Sam Walton made it work.
Well, as you mentioned in the book, Steele was raising his own chickens, growing his own food.
Exactly. They had cafeterias, and he was big on vertical integration, which is not a unique concept to him. But for his cafeterias, he was famous. I've got a chapter in a book called the best 50-cent chicken dinner in Canada. And he was famous for his chicken dinner, so he turned his big home out in Gettysville into a chicken farm. And then, of course, he started a company called Steele Farm Systems and started selling stock in it to help support the chicken farm. But he had a chicken farm, and then for the candy stores, he bought a sugar plantation in Florida. And then right near the end, to support the entire enterprise, he bought a coal mine in Virginia because he was going to have fuel for his entire enterprise out of that coal mine. So a lot of vertical integration.
Well, this is Henry Ford buying rubber plantations in Brazil.
Yep.
So
yep.
People would have believed this stuff.
Yeah, yeah. They did.
Thank you, Dave Dyer.
Thank you.